This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
We're going to start by making a cut in the middle of our chicken breast, and then we're going to fill it with some tinfoil.
Hi, I'm Rachel Hampton, and you're listening to ICYMI. In case you missed it, Slate's podcast about internet culture. And this week is a momentous one, and no, I am not talking about the queen finally kicking the bucket. Today, ICYMI is finally getting its long-deserved recognition on an international stage in none other than the dictionary. On Wednesday, Merriam-Webster announced that it was inducting more than 350 new words and terms into its hallowed halls of lexiconical fame, including yeet, great choice, pumpkin spice, meh, MacGyver, and Luk, spelled L-E-W-K, pronounced Luk, not look. But the thing is, I don't give a shit about any of these, because the most important addition is I-C-Y-M-motherfucking-I. Some of you might be sitting at home thinking, Rachel, that's just an abbreviation. You named your show after an abbreviation, and they're adding it to the dictionary. And to you, I would say, quit being a motherfucking hater. You're just trying to keep a bad bitch down, because I know deep in my soul that when you look up ICYMI in the dictionary now, you'll see a little cartoon head of my face. And that is powerful. Mama, I made it. On today's show, we are going to be talking about food, specifically the wild and constantly changing world of the internet food content economy. Despite how much I love food, and I love food to the point that I will not eat if the food is not good, we actually don't discuss it that often here on the show unless it's something viscerally disgusting like pink sauce or viral like the Emily Mariko salmon bowl, which I continue to eat once a week, and that's a conservative estimate. So when we decided to do today's episode, I knew I needed to call in an expert. Later in the show, y'all be hearing from one of my favorite food writers and internet presences, Bettina McAlintel. She's currently a reporter at Eater, and she's written for Bon Appetit and Vice. She also has an absolutely incredible TikTok at CrispyEgg420, where she documents some of the beautiful food she's eating, and it is chef's kiss in like the original iteration of the term. Together, we'll be discussing the changes that TikTok has wrought on internet food content, the kind of inherent entitlement that we as viewers tend to approach food content with, and the bygone era of tasty videos. All of that after a short break.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
The new Starz series, Mary and George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true. But shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son, George, on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. Trust me, you've never seen a mother-son duo like this before. The show is full of wit, scandal, action, and did I mention Julianne Moore? Something this audacious and sexy as genre-bending as it gets. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Mary and George now, only on Starz and the Starz app.
And we're back with Bettina McAlintel, a reporter for Eater who has been covering internet food culture for about 4 years now.
When I sort of came into food writing, it was like 2018, so it was still very like the height of Instagram. And so I think it was sort of like the, you know, we were really hitting that sort of like professionalization of Instagram, or it was like a lot of people were professional bloggers and professional sort of Instagram creators. And they sort of, you know, they had that like look of stylized, perfect food. And I think that the really big change that I've seen more recently has sort of been like the rise of TikTok, right? And sort of like this like destabilization of the like professional Instagram food or food blogger model. And it's sort of much more like anyone can sort of make food content now. And it's like, there is sort of less of the sense that everything needs to look sort of perfect, or that you need to be, you know, a particular kind of chef or particular kind of recipe developer to be making food content. And so I think it's like now we're just sort of seeing like a lot more people making things and a lot more people sort of like being included in like the food content world.
Yeah, definitely. I feel like 2018 was around maybe the end of the tasty video era, where everything was like the disembodied hand shot from overhead. And now we have the kind of, I feel like the content I gravitate towards is usually what people describe as like cozy. So like you actually know who the person is who's making it. I do think that's like TikTok kind of revolutionized that.
Yeah, totally. And I think it was partially just also like with COVID, like so many people were home and so many people were cooking, and then were just also sort of like coincidentally making videos on their phones.
2020 was also the moment when TikTok really came to dominate the U.S. social media scene. It's the year when, I'm going to say adults because the teens have always been up on this shit, where adults realized that the platform was more than like Charli D'Amelio dancing. So you have this kind of seismic shift away from the professionalized, glossy Instagram aesthetic towards the sort of intentionally homespun TikTok vibe, which brings us to a beautiful tweet that you sent out on August 30th. Something I've been thinking about a lot, especially after seeing complaints about Emily Mariko's bowls as boring, repetitive, is how so much food online is interpreted and assumed as primarily done for other people, an audience, as product content versus nourishment with filming secondary. And I have to ask, like, what inspired this tweet? What were you doing at 9 a.m. on a Tuesday that had you just ready to send off this incredibly like, succinct tweet?
Okay, so I think part of it is that, like, there was, like, sort of this conversation happening about gloves in cooking videos, like, at that time. And sort of how, you know, a lot of people are weird about gloves on, like, when they watch a video. Like, there's sort of this expectation that people, you know, some people really want to see anyone cooking, like, wearing gloves for some reason. But also sometimes it's kind of weird because it's, like, a lot of people are just cooking at home for themselves. But so why would they wear gloves, right? Yeah. And so there was sort of, like, this little conversation on Twitter just about, you know, how people are wearing gloves and sort of like gloves is sometimes like indicating that food is like meant to be sort of consumed by other people and not just like something that the creator is going to like eat themselves, right? But also I think the bigger picture thing is just that as a person who has sort of like accidentally become a person who like shares a lot of my cooking online, I think that I see a lot of these sort of expectations around, you know, what people, how people sort of are interpreting food, even if it's just like, you know, I would describe myself as like a normal person who likes to cook, like posting my cooking. But I think that sometimes when I'm like posting my cooking or seeing the way people interact with my content, I can tell that they see sort of, you know, they don't see it as just like me making lunch. They see it as like a video that they should learn from. And the food is sort of there for like their instructional benefit, for example.
You mentioned Emily Mariko in your tweet, and I think that she kind of perfectly gets at this dynamic that you're referring to, this idea that making food content is inherently instructional rather than for the edification of the person creating it. That's the sound of Mariko making one of her dishes. Most of her videos don't include her voice. And for our listeners who aren't familiar with Mariko, we did an episode on her viral salmon rice bowl that, as I said, I still eat at least once a week. The episode is called The TikTok Salmon Bowl Can't Save Us, and it came out on October 16 of last year. All of this to say, Bettina, how do you feel about Mariko?
I find her videos very enjoyable. I find her food very enjoyable. Like, it's a lot of stuff that I would eat. And I think that, like, the interesting thing has been, like, to see sort of the backlash to Emily Mariko in that it's like, I think there's this thing on the internet where like a person or a thing gets to a certain level of sort of popularity or views, and then people just start hating for no reason, right? Like, and so I feel like Emily Marco is a person who's very much ended up in this position that, like, I'm not sure that she, like, meant to be TikTok's sort of, like, go-to, like, casual cooking person. Yeah. But it just sort of ended up that way. And so I think that, you know, and I think that's opened her up to a ton of, like, sort of weird criticism that I think that, you know, if I, like, I, as a fairly normal person, like, start cooking, you know, you could very much make the argument that, like, my food is, like, boring or repetitive, or that I do some weird thing with my posture or whatever, right? But I think that, like, I think that sometimes the criticism she gets is sort of, like, overblown just because she's so big.
I remember when the salmon bowl first went viral, there was this almost surprise that someone that looked like her was eating rice, because I think so many people are used to aspirational food content.
I think that part of this too, speaking of the aspirational thing, is like, I feel like we're in an interesting moment with like almost like a backlash to aspirational things, like the photo jump aesthetic and this sort of like presenting yourself on the internet in a way that seems more like air quotes real has made, I think, a lot of people sort of immediately, you know, dislike anything that sort of looks air quotes like intentionally aspirational. But I think the thing that I like think about a lot is the fact that like sometimes people are doing things on the internet that like has that that like image of being aspirational, but it's not really meant to, like, I don't think it's like, I don't know. I think that sometimes I'll get comments about like my food being a lot of effort or a lot of work, right? And I think, but it's mostly because I like it. It's not because I'm trying to, like, you know, create some image that I think other people need to sort of opt into.
Okay, so I love that you're bringing up your kind of accidental foray into influencing. It is actually one of the reasons I wanted to have you on the show. You single-handedly turned last summer into my summer of big metal bowl salads, and I have not looked back since. But did you notice this inherently instructional dynamic first as a creator or as a journalist?
I think I always noticed from afar the sort of like, you know, someone posts a picture and they'll get like a recipe in the comments, right? Mm-hmm. Like even if there isn't a recipe, they'll like, people will request it. So I think I sort of noticed that, but it didn't really sort of, but I don't think I really sort of thought about it in a bigger picture sense until I started posting my own content.
Yeah. So when you say a bigger picture sense, what do you think this dynamic, where do you think it's emerged from? And what do you think it kind of says about where we are right now in terms of like internet food content?
Yeah, so I mean, I think part of it is like, is that transition from sort of like the blogger Instagram era to this like democratized TikTok food era, where like, I think that a lot of people sort of got used to seeing, you know, blogger recipes on Instagram, and they knew it would come with a recipe, and they knew that it was going to be something that was like, you know, that would, it would click through to a blog, or it would be like some way of promoting someone's cookbook or something like that. And I think that like with TikTok, you know, and more people making things, and like, I think that TikTok, you know, spans this much bigger range of like educational videos, but there's also like the vibey ASMR stuff that's like fully just for like, you know, the feeling and not sort of the instruction. And I think that's part of it is sort of not everyone who's watching it understands that sort of breadth of like content types. And so I think that sometimes people will see things that are meant to be sort of like vibes or ASMR or just like archiving or documenting. And I think they still sort of bring that like expectation of sort of the previous era to it. So I think that is sort of like the big thing. Because with TikTok, you're not, you know, I think even more so than Instagram, you're like not really controlling how you see something or like what, you don't see the context of like a creator's other work. You're just sort of seeing the video and like putting your own expectations onto it.
Yeah, TikTok really collapses context in a way that no other social media platform has before, right? Like when you follow an Instagram food blogger or you follow someone on Tumblr or Twitter, you know what kind of content you're signing up for, whether it be vibey or shit posting or instructional. But TikTok's algorithm just puts anyone into your FYP, which means that viewers are really kind of just pulling creators into their own context. There's this interesting dynamic I see now in the comments section where a commenter will ask a creator to do something like a certain makeup look or a recipe or try out something or whatever. And the creator will comment back, "I've already done that, just scroll back." And that dynamic seems really specific to TikTok. The demand for a recipe on every food video is really interesting, especially for someone like you, Bettina, who isn't trying to do this full time. You're just posting to post.
Yeah, I think I think that's the thing that makes it weird is that like I'm fully just posting for myself and I sort of enjoy the act of like lately I haven't because it's so much work. But like I do sometimes enjoy the act of like filming or like making the content. Right. And I'm like doing that because I like it. And I'm not necessarily doing it because I want to show like the most discreet, like understandable steps for a viewer, you know.
Mm-hmm. Where do you think that kind of it's almost a sense of entitlement. Where do you think it comes from?
Oh, yeah, it's definitely a sense of entitlement. I think it's just, it's just the fact that people are so used to everything on the internet being free for so long, you know, like it's like the recipe thing, or it's the expectation that, you know, your favorite creator is going to respond to you and tell you where they got their jeans. Like there is just this, I think we've just like gotten to this point where the internet where people just expect things and they don't want to do the sort of like extra step of like opening up the Chrome tab and like searching for it themselves. They like expect that it should be there for them.
Okay, hold that thought because we have to take a short break. When we come back, we'll discuss how this sense of entitlement affects creators, whether it's specific to food content and the default assumption that everyone posting online is trying to be a capital C content creator.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love. Books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
And we're back with Bettina. Before the break, we were talking about the ways that TikTok collapses the context that creators are creating in and how that encourages viewers to basically assume that the creator of every piece of content that crosses their feed has the same intent, which is to be an influencer. Bettina, you came up with a great term for this in a follow-up tweet to the one we were discussing before the break. You described it as the everyone is a content creator economy. Can you tell me a little bit more about this?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think it's hard. I hate everything is because of TikTok. But I do think that
it's a seismic shift. Like the app changed a lot.
Like, I do think that, like, TikTok, for example, like, made a lot more people feel like they, like, I feel like before with YouTube, it didn't feel like you were, like, I didn't feel like I was gonna, like, make a video of my morning routine, right? Like, it felt a lot more, like, inaccessible or felt like more work. And I feel like with TikTok, we sort of normalized, like, everyone filming everything and sort of interacting with daily life in a way that is, like, you are aware of how you could present it to other people.
Part of that seismic shift that TikTok's really kind of honed is the ability to go viral without intending to. And that existed and exists on other platforms like Twitter and Tumblr, somewhat on Facebook, but the TikTok algorithm really does sometimes seem to just pick things to go viral at random, turning normal people into public figures overnight. See Couch Guy. But what that's created to me, and at least it sounds like to you as well, Bettina, is this pervasive idea that basically everyone's trying to be an influencer until proven otherwise. And if it's coming from an influencer, it's aspirational. And if it's aspirational, it needs to come with an instruction manual.
I mean, I think if anything, I think it's just going to, I don't know. I think we're just moving in a direction where, like, you know, because it seems like increasingly more TikTok chefs are like trying to sell you something, or there's more and more people who are using TikTok as a way of promoting like this thing that they're going to mail to you or sell for you or whatever, right? And so I think we're just moving more into this thing where people interpret sort of what they're seeing on TikTok, especially with food, as like some sort of ad or some sort of product or something that they can opt into in their personal lives.
Yeah, and that really feels especially true with food.
I think it's partially that so much of how people have interacted with food media content, you know, pre-social media even, was like intended to be instructional. Like if you watched the Food Network, for example, yeah, everything, like most sort of food things you watched were either like completely a competition or it was like a cooking host sort of explaining everything to you. And I don't think that we've had necessarily like these like examples of like vibey food content or like ASMR food content really until, you know, the social media era. And I think that like especially, you know, a lot of that was easy to sort of ignore on YouTube. Like I think there's a lot of people who still never saw like ASMR food on YouTube. It just sort of like passes them by. Yeah. But I think like on like an Instagram feed or in a TikTok FYP, that stuff sort of like, you know, it's going to new people for the first time, I think.
Something I've been thinking about lately is how this affects people of color specifically. Like, the demand that a dish be easily replicable really does just kind of end up exotifying certain cooking techniques or ingredients. And it's usually those that most Westerners haven't interacted with. Like, to be aspirational has to be relatable. And what's deemed relatable is usually what's deemed white.
I don't know. I think that people of color definitely, I feel like especially with food, there sort of is more scrutiny almost.
Yeah.
Like, for example, like I noticed that like I did a thing in a cooking video that I saw like a much bigger white food creator do. Not that, you know, not that much before me. And like I definitely got more criticism for it. Mm. And I was like, okay, this is interesting because, you know, because it's like the same technique, not like I'm necessarily like saying anything different or doing anything that's like super different. But I was like, this is an interesting sort of like data point. I think race definitely affects sort of how sometimes people perceive your authority on in food content.
I feel like there's this way in which when people of color are cooking on TikTok that like the ingredients or the techniques or the dishes they're making are kind of framed as like inaccessible in a way that like other people maybe might not be. Like, I remember, like, specifically, like, Emily Marco, people are like, where do I find Kewpie mayo?
Totally. I think that also just from, like, a content creation standpoint, it's like, if I'm putting a caption on something, right, it's like, what do I feel like is, like, I feel like Kewpie mayo, for example, is so basic that you don't need to explain it, right?
Yeah.
But then sort of reading comments, you realize, like, certain things, like, oh, maybe people would have preferred if there was a caption explaining it, right? Even though it's, even if it seems, like, very familiar to me, like, there is still the sense that you, like, sort of can't control who your audience is and that you might be, that, like, there are people who might not understand sort of, like, my perspective or what I'm doing.
Yeah, it's kind of like the explanational comma or whatever, where it's like, what exactly am I going to choose to explain to people and like why? And I feel like that when you're a content creator and that is the choice that you're making as your career, then you err on the side of doing more. But when you're just a normal person posting, it's like, why do I have to explain my life to you?
Yeah, exactly.
That dynamic seems really frustrating, of just wanting to share and document your own life only for people to come in and kind of demand a step-by-step tutorial. I see accusations of gatekeeping flying around a lot, especially on TikTok, when someone refuses to share how they do their makeup or where they got something, which, okay, I have to say, sometimes I catch myself tapping on my non-influencer friend's Instagram post to see where they got their dress, which means I'm also brain poisoned. And it is sometimes frustrating when you see something you like and you don't have the immediate link to go buy it. But I'm also not owed that information, you know? And on the flip side, I do think having access to these, like, aspirational lifestyles kind of fucks a lot of people over.
You know, I think that there is this sense that if you're, I think there can be this sense that if you're not making like an elaborate, beautiful meal, or if you're eating something that's the same all the time, or that you're like making something that's just totally like thrown together, fully sustenance. Like, I think that sometimes that can feel like it can feel like you're doing something wrong if you're not sort of like, you're not doing the most with your food. And I think that can be, that's really hard. Like, I think the Instagram like blogger era was really hard in that it like set up all of these unrealistic expectations for people about how they should cook. And like, you know, for most people, like I cook in a really sort of like extra way because that's like what I like to do and I have the time and it's my main hobby. But you know, I think that sometimes this like way of presenting and interacting with food online can sort of ignore the fact that like most people don't want to do that. Like most people just like literally just want to feed themselves. And I think the thing is also that, like, I always think about the fact that, like, there's so much stuff that I make that I don't post online, right? Like, I am sort of, like, even though I'm sort of trying to be, like, a normal person cooking and I'm trying to show, you know, I'm, like, obviously still showing stuff that's, like, the best version and I'm not going to post every single day when I'm just eating, like tuna mayo on rice, right? Like, I'm not posting that. Like, I've been eating that every day for breakfast, but, you know, it doesn't make it onto the feed. And so I think it's just, like, remembering, like, I feel like, yeah, I feel like we're all sort of always remembering that, like, no matter how things shift on sort of, like, what we're seeing on TikTok and Instagram, it's still always a choice of, like, what you're posting and what you're not sharing. I just think that we're in a sort of very interesting time for sort of, like, food and the internet, and there are things that are exciting about the current moment where I'm like, oh, there's, like, more normal people cooking and sharing their food. But then, you know, I think there's still a lot of these, like, existing pressures and expectations that we're still sort of falling into.
That was Bettina McAlintel, a reporter at Eater. You can find her on TikTok at CrispyEgg420 and on Twitter at Bettina Mac. That is M-A-K. I really loved our conversation, specifically the fact that it released me from the pressure to cook every single beautiful meal that I see coming across my TikTok feed. And I hope it did for y'all too. All right, that is the show. We'll be back in your feed on Wednesday, so please subscribe. It is the best way to never miss an episode, to never miss a discussion about food. Please leave a rating and review in Apple or Spotify and tell your friends about us. Tell your chef friends about us. You can follow us on Twitter at @icym_pod, which is also where you can DM us your questions and your favorite TikTok recipes. I don't promise to make them. And you can always drop us a note at icymi@slate.com. ICYMI is produced by Daniel Schrader and me, Rachel Hampton. Daisy Rosario is our senior supervising producer, and Alicia Montgomery is Slate's VP of audio. See you online or in the kitchen. Bitch, not rest in power to the fucking queen. Hi, y'all. I hope you're enjoying today's show. If this is your first time listening, then a welcome to the ICYMI squad. We are thrilled to have you here. In case you missed it, that joke is made every single week, and we come out twice a week on Wednesdays and Saturdays. You are currently listening to the Saturday episode, and this Wednesday's episode was on an illicit production of Hamilton put on by a church in a city in Texas, a city that happens to be my nemesis. You don't want to miss it.